Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. This show is available on iTunes, and like all of the podcasts here at WFYI, available on Spotify. Well, friends, I have company starting this week's show, and sometimes film sociology turns into stage sociology, and in this case with my two guests, it is shameless self-promotion sociology. So I got Casey Ross and Tom Alvarez in studio with me. Both are involved in their own way with other producers of A Streetcar Named Desire, which is opening this weekend. So hi, gang. Oh, let's try this again. Hi, gang.
Hello. Hello, hello.
Hello, hello, hello.
So, so Casey, give us the info on this since you're directing the shindig.
Sure. So Tom and I are actually co-producers. We both have theater companies of our own. So I am the artistic director of Catalyst Repertory Theater.
Bielstock.
yes, totally. And we usually specialize in new plays, but another part of our mission statement is new adaptations of classic plays. So I thought about doing Streetcar Named Desire in kind of a bold, new, and exciting way and approached Tom and Magic Thread to come in and provide a live kind of film-esque underscore, and it's in the round. And I think it's going to be really special because it is two companies coming together in Indy to create something different.
So a theatrical Reese cup.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Yeah, you can. You're pledged dollars at work. I get credit for that. So, Tom, is she right?
Yeah.
Oh, I've had guests before. No, that's nope. Never happened before. What do you mean? So, I guess I want to ask each of you before this production, what is your history with A Streetcar Named Desire?
My history, it's one of my favorite films. And since this is the film show,
thank you.
Obviously, the film itself is iconic, as you know, and I don't know how many times I saw it. And I saw it most recently with, and we'll talk about Dustin Klein, my collaborator,
yeah,
and who is providing the underscoring. He's written these beautiful themes for the show, so it has we maintain a filmic quality. So, but I have seen the film a number of times, including most recently I sat down with Dustin. It is one of my favorite films, and those performances, Marlon Brando and Vivian Leigh, and Carl Malden, Indiana
yep.
Hoosier,
yep.
They rank high in my estimate. One of my favorite classic films, yes. And what were you asking? I've lost my train of thought.
No, you're doing fine. No, I was just your history with it. I mean,
that's my history with it. And, you know, I mean, I'm a theater. So when I was a young theater student, you know, we read the play and did some scene study work with it. And when I graduated, the class behind me actually did a production of it. And, you know, college-age students doing Streetcar, it was really, at
ooh,
the
boy.
Time, very revolutionary
ooh,
and innovative. They did an excellent job, by the way.
Okay.
So that's kind of my history
like
of it.
Like kids doing The Winter's Tale.
And when
yes.
Casey asked me to, you know, asked me to be a part of the production as part of our partnership with Magic Thread, I turned her down, and then I slept on I thought, wow, how could I not participate in this project, you mm-hmm. know. And by the way, Pablo Gonzalez is Latino, and Casey, being very in tune to you know, representation, when she asked
all representations can be brutes,
exactly. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I was really flattered that she asked, and it's been 30 years since I've been on stage. we can, you know, and I've got a backstory and everything for her. So.
Well, and I ask that because, you know, as far as our own paths, everybody's path with a play is different. And then when you become involved with a particular project, it alters. And I tell the story of, years ago, I got to play Benedick in Much Ado. And before that, I had seen, you know, Sir Ken's version like once a year. It was like one of those things you watch a lot. And then I had my own experience with the show. And then as soon as we closed, I spent one lazy Sunday morning, got a pot of coffee, and revisited it. And it changed my point of view with the film. Doesn't make it better, doesn't make it worse. It's just different because I had my own journey with it. So that's why. So, Casey, what is your history with Streetcar?
So, as we were talking before we started, I'm not a big film buff. I've obviously seen the film. But I studied the play quite extensively in college, and I actually went to Hanover College, wherein one of my professors and mentors is one of the foremost Tennessee Williams scholars. So I've learned about Streetcar in depth. I have been in Glass Menagerie twice. So, like, I have more of a history of Williams than just Streetcar specifically. I run a repertory troupe, and so I do a lot of tough guy kind of heavy plays because a lot of my members are that character type. And when I was thinking of a Williams classic American piece I wanted to do, I was like, you know, Streetcar would be kind of a surprising show for us. And I think it's kind of sadly timeless. And and it's definitely a show that I wanted to explore as something surprising from the theater. So
I will. I'll get to my connection in a little bit because I know you're. I know exactly where you know where I'm going, Casey. On this, it was a Valentine for you. Tell us how you're remounting this show because I think when you have an idea of Williams as far as the apartments and the characters, how are you making this your own?
As a theater company, we tend to have a little bit of a minimalist approach.
Yep.
So again, that's why Williams is kind of a shocker because his work is so literal, and you need like a full house, and you need every single tiny prop.
Yeah.
Blanche describes every outfit that she puts on. Like, oh my gosh, poor Sarah has like 6-7 costume changes. And so I thought it would be interesting to deal with this idea of entrapment. It's really hot. It's in this tiny little 2-room house. It's New Orleans. They're stuck together for this summer. And I think that's why everyone reaches their boiling points individually. So the show is in the round. The audience is going to be on all 4 sides, which is the first time that the Fringe Building has ever done anything in the round.
Wow, okay.
It's a tiny space.
Yep.
So, you know, the
in
cast
your face.
Is, yeah, the cast is very much in your laps. But the concept is kind of that they can't escape. The audience is literally the walls. So we are the flies on their walls. So, like, costume changes happen on stage. And kind of once the show kicks off, they're not going to leave. The music is coming from a piano that exists in their world because we're just playing that the little piano bar is around the corner and you can always see Dustin and Courtney, our vocalist that's going to be doing some of the score.
Also known as the Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee of this production. Look it up, stage nerds.
I'm going to have to look
that
one
up. They were the street musicians in the original Broadway run.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So, Blue
cool.
Show. Yeah, the Blue Show, the film
was,
show.
I knew there was a live orchestra in the original run because you have to purchase the original, like, publication of the script.
Aren't there stage directions in Williams about music as well?
Yeah, the Streetcar literally has orchestra plays in and out. Like, it tells you.
Right. It seems like, yes, like, so Mr. Williams' lawyers go, look over there.
We did it.
Trust me, I did a show with, I kept waiting for Mr. Albee's lawyers to pop in. Thank God they didn't. So
I'm still waiting for Mr. Shepard to call me and be mad that I cut a single page of his script.
Oh, dear. So anyway, but yeah, I get that. I understand. And the minimalist as well, because I saw photos of you guys building the set and it looks very cool, very minimalist. And for me, it's you're focusing more on the characters. You don't have to.
Yes.
And you're not there for 6 days, all day, all night, banging it. Because I know you like in certain shows, you get in the space for just a few days.
Oh, yeah. We got into the space Sunday. And we got most of the set up, but it is 2 stories. And so we had floor 1 built on Sunday, mm-hmm. and then floor 2 came Monday. So we're really only like 2 days on the set, which admittedly, having a two-story set in the round and only having 3 days in the space kind of changes everything that you thought you knew.
I was about to ask you, did you have in your mind a backup plan in case floor two didn't happen?
No, actually.
All right.
I'm kind of demanding when I want my way as a director. And, you know, I got like, I'm going to go ahead and say he's probably one of the best scenic designers, young scene designers in Indianapolis. He does a lot of work at IRT in Phoenix, Nick Kilgore. And we altered some of what floor two became because the banisters were getting in the way. And Stanley's very tall, so he was kind of hanging out with some lighting up there. So there were tweaks, but I knew that overall the concept could be done.
Okay.
And I had faith in my team.
And it's good to have that faith.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So very good. Okay, so let's go to, and I will say this, I did a variation of Streetcar in the last show I directed, and I did a Midsummer Night's Dream. I set it in Athens, Louisiana, and the question is always, how do you do the play within the play? Well, the first play that came to mind, I did a Streetcar named Pyramus and Thisbe. So I had our buddy Kelsey as Stanley, as Pyramus, and Justina was Thisbe as Blanche. And Kelsey had seen it before, and Justina had not. And they told me, they said, I watched it. And I said, I didn't care which version you watch, because there's a slew of TV films and National Theater Live or what have you. And they said to me, I almost stopped after the final 20 minutes. And I said, I understand that. I appreciate you getting through it. Also, the fact that we did a twist on her last Blanche's last line in the play, in the film. So I'm glad that you did that. So let's address the elephant in the room. How are we handling the brutality that Stanley brings to this play?
I think when works are timeless, especially timeless in a frightening way, mm-hmm. like in dealing with domestic violence, in dealing with class struggle and that kind of thing, it's important to not pull your punches. So there was a lot of talk of like, well, you know, I've seen productions where they just go off stage and that bad stuff happens and it's implied and we don't have to do it. And I was like, it's in the round. There's no off stage.
If it's Athens, Louisiana, if it's if the old Greek and Roman style.
And so, I mean, I guess the easy answer is we're just going to do the play as it's written. It is pretty brutal. I have said it's a 16 plus content warning because the scene in question and that brutality happens on stage. None of the slaps or the domestic violence is shied away from. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we talked extensively with the cast. We had several meetings. We'd always have a second pair of eyes in the room when dealing with intimacy or brutality, because it's important to make sure people are taken care of with their mental health in a show like this. But I also feel it's important that you don't stray away from what the show is.
Mm-hmm. And how is your cast doing?
They're doing very well. This is one of the most exciting casts I've worked with, and it's one of the largest casts I've worked
yeah,
with.
Yeah, it is.
It's a big cast.
Yeah.
Well, how do you think the cast is doing, Tom, from within?
You're there.
Other perspective.
Well, I have to point out the elephant in the room. I'm a reviewer, and I've been reviewing theater for 45 years.
Yes, you have.
I've seen the best in the world, not only in Indianapolis, but I've reviewed Chicago, New York, L.A., other markets. So I think I know my stuff. And
yes.
As a reviewer, I haven't been on stage for 30 years because I made a decision long ago that I didn't want to muddy the waters. I felt it would be a conflict of interest for me to review other artists and then myself be on stage doing work. Part of it, too, I'll admit, back, you know, there was a time when I, you know, it was probably misguided ego. I thought, well, I don't want to, like, people have an opportunity to take shots, you know, pot shots at me if I gave someone a bad review or whatever. But, you know, the truth is that I've never been the kind of reviewer that have taken cheap shots or have been anything but an advocate. I'm an advocate first. So
yep.
To get to the point of all this, I realized after some time I really, really missed acting. I'm trained as an actor. I do a lot of acting in commercials. I have a whole career of being an actor and videos, films, and whatever, but I missed the theater experience. And so when Casey asked me, you know, I turned her down, but as I said, I slept on it, and I decided, you know, I've been yearning to do this, but didn't really admit it. And so when I reconsidered, I thought, you know, I miss the process. I miss the bonding that takes place with actors. I miss the whole milieu. Mm-hmm. So it's been just an incredible opportunity for me to work with this particular cast. And I don't give false compliments as a reviewer. And I can tell you this is not disingenuous. With that reviewer's hat on, not only watching my fellow actors at work, and of course Casey's direction, I give her feedback all the time. I'm astounded at the quality of this production. You know, Casey recently posted about community theater. It's often cast in derogatory terms.
No.
Patronizing, condescending language. Oh. But, you know, actors who are community theater as opposed to equity actors, the only difference is oftentimes money, influence, yeah. Networking, marketing, whatever you want to call it.
Yep. But
we have actors in Indianapolis who are as good as anybody on any stage I've seen. And I can tell you, and there's some newcomers in this cast, mm-hmm. I sit there and I get to interact with these people in character. And to be up and close and personal gives me a viewpoint I think is really unique. And again, if I were reviewing the play, I often share, by the way, I said, Casey, I'd like for you to like take a look at my perspective, because if I were reviewing, this is what the review is going to look like, look for.
Yep.
And these are things that we need to be aware of. Detail. As a reviewer, I'm always aware of detail, and because I'm an actor, I know what to look for in a performance, and I feel I can judge it objectively. These actors are astounding, and the quality, and the four leads, when they work together, they could be on any stage in this town. So that's my perspective.
Well, and I'm glad you brought that up, because I think there's a few things. As somebody who has acted and somebody who has directed, and then being directed by other people, especially in my case, my wife, my kid, both my in-laws, you know, if they want to ask me a question, they'll ask.
Yeah.
They got a project, they know what they need to work on. But on the other part for you, and I understand the critic aspect of it. You're definitely not Rex Reed, and unless Casey, you want to do Myra Breckinridge next season, but I think there's
slap
that
it on there, yeah.
I throw the strangest suggestions to you, you know that, but I think there's that aspect of, because I love to do stage as well and review films, and it, for me, it breaks the, oh, critics are just frustrated artists, and me doing plays is kind of my middle finger to that stereotype, that theory. But I think also from when I was at Ball State, I would preview any play for the newspaper. Just don't let me review them, because I want to actually kind of work with others. So, mm-hmm. But yeah, to see the art from your perspective, it brings a fresh pair of eyes, especially those that have been either young or in working in different ways.
I also think that the perspective that I bring from it as an actor is. It's wonderful to rediscover my first love on mm-hmm. stage, and to have this opportunity. It just brings me so much joy and satisfaction. And the overall production, I can guarantee, I've never seen anything like it in all my years of reviewing. Not quite like this. The set,
yeah.
For one, I've told Casey that I have just never seen a set like this in the round in an intimate space. Her whole concept, I dare say, is brilliant. It's truly brilliant, and I stand by that.
Well, and that's out of the show for one night. Go ahead and review it.
No, but
actually, I am going to review it. We haven't talked about this. I am going to review it, but not in the standard manner. I'm going to approach it from the standpoint of being in the cast. I think it'll be a really unique viewpoint that I'd like to share.
So long as you end it with, and that old, forget that old guy, he's terrible. He's just the word. No, no, it's like. In the third person.
To be able to do that objectively, but I'm not going to approach it in the standard way.
Of course, yeah.
I am going to report on it.
Of course.
Yeah, I think it'll be a lot of fun.
And where could people read this review when it happens, Tom?
Well, it's on my website, tomalvarez.studio. You know, the great thing about having this platform, and as you know, I'm also on Lifestyle Live as their...
We all do. Anybody who's done theater are like, hey, Tom, I have a show, and it's coming.
You know, I have to say that I am so grateful that I have been given this platform. It wasn't handed me. You know, I've worked myself my whole career to get where to I am. No one handed it to me. And I didn't start out in TV doing what I do now. I started out, you know, doing a public affairs show. I was like an early Vanna White pointing to job descriptions, you know. And I was really
and
bad.
And the gams
I
for
was
it.
Really bad at it, by the way, until I discovered the control room and, you know, I was a producer director. But fast forward, I've got these great platforms and I get to promote people like Casey, Catalyst Repertory. I get to do my own production stuff. It's very cool. And as you know, having a platform allowing you to support artists, how great is that?
Yeah.
Right?
And nowadays, you can throw a rock and hit a theater company in the city. So it's nice to have choices.
And there's so little arts coverage. IBJ is gone. The Star is gone. The Indianapolis News. Charles Staff and Jay Harvey. They're all gone. And who's left but... folks on you and Steven
and to be fair, Jay has a page as well.
Exactly.
So, although we need to find my dinner with Andre, maybe with you and him.
And of course, I want to mention, you know, my fellow online writers, Jay Harvey and Lou Harry,
Ken's still around.
Wendy, but you know, we're the only game left in town.
Yep.
You know, so
we're gonna keep digging in. Like I think we got a bunch of Margot Channings running around. Gonna get there.
Well, hopefully there's some new people will come forward and start using the airwaves of the internet to support the arts.
Big on the internet, I think.
When we'll see. Yeah.
Theater needs to embrace social media and YouTube and streaming and all of the stuff that's available to us. Why not?
Do we have the wacky behind the scenes videos on TikTok of Stanley and Blanche and Stella? Yeah.
We haven't been utilizing our TikTok as much as we probably should during rehearsal, but I do have plans to say, like, hey, when the show starts, like, here's the account, log in, and you guys can just post crazy stuff to Catalyst. Have fun.
Very good.
Go ham.
And you don't have to say it twice.
I have an uncharacteristically funny Stanley. He's almost charming.
I think the darker the material can be, you have to have that levity. It won't be seen on stage.
Someone who just did the Pillow Man. I'd agree.
Our Stanley Kowalski, because you told me about him, and I asked him as we were standing in the wings waiting to go on. I said, so I understand you went to clown college. And he said, yeah,
that was not a slight.
Because in rehearsal, I love watching. He's so playful and it's so inventive. And, you know, when he's doing his, it can immediately, on a dime,
switch
and switch to being like a comedian on stage and make funny jokes. And he's just a hoot.
He's very funny.
It's nice to have that, especially when you have, you know, a battering ram running around your circle in the Roundstedt when the action's going on.
Oh, he's a funny guy.
His portrayal is also, it's almost more chilling when he goes dark. Because, like I said, like it's a Stanley's almost charming situation. Mm-hmm. Like he's funny.
Sure.
As a person, as an actor, outside of, you know, the show in his real life, he's a super nice guy. Like, we went to college together, and I've known him pretty well for a long time.
When he lumbers around as Stanley, he lumbers. Like,
yeah.
You know, Blanche describes the ape. I mean, he literally has this body that moves like a big gorilla.
A big string bean.
Big knuckle dragging.
And he is scariest when his character, you know, goes off.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really something to watch.
The contrast makes the scary even scarier.
And, you know, Blanche is very petite.
Both the ladies are very
well. Although Sarah, the first time Sarah and I worked, we were both in Henry IV, and she was one of the heavies in this. So I think the next thing I saw her in was Beatrice. So, yeah, looking forward to seeing that.
Yeah.
So, and the other thing with the play is, and with Shakespeare and other classical plays, is I'm excited to see how they're going to do it. Yeah, we've seen it this way, we've seen it that way. I think the last streetcar I saw was in this town probably 20 years ago.
Did you see the Chris and Lisa Ermel?
It was at Carrie
Slaughter.
Yeah, it was not the Rathskeller, but it was there. So there was that, and then prior to that,
we're bringing it back.
I got to see
that was 20 years ago.
It's a long time ago. Yeah, and then before that, I got to see Gary Sinise do it at Steppenwolf. It was the late 90s. Yeah, this is my theater company
has a crush on the Steppenwolf.
Just don't actually hit each other for rolling up and down the aisles. But I was working for a suburban newspaper in the Chicago burbs at that time, and I had two female coworkers, one that found Gary Sinise hot, the other that found Stanley hot, and then to sit between them. And and then when Stella happens, I can hear my colleagues hyperventilating for slightly different reasons.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay. Oh, boy.
So you worked with Sarah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we were doing Henry IV. It's funny because I played Falstaff. I had to wear the fat suit, thank God. Yeah. But there's that. It's funny you mentioned the lumbering aspect of it, of, you know, the physicality, and especially when you had something extra on you. So the fact that he's able to use his clown college flexibility.
You know, I also want to point out that, you know, who hasn't, unless you've been living under a rock but Marlon Brando and Vivian Leigh, their performances are burned in people's memory.
And that's a tough act to follow.
For actors to take those roles and put their own stamp on them, that has to be the weight of that challenge. And these two really do, in my estimation, they have put their own stamp on these performances. And in really subtle ways so it's clear that folks will see these two actors take on that challenge and do it so well. I'm just so impressed with that.
Yeah, I definitely, we talked early on, like all of us as a cast and even at the read through, that we don't want to see anybody doing an impersonation of the film.
Of course not. That's a lot of mumbling for your guy.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Sorry, Mrs. Sosi, and now my kid likes to refer to Mr. Brando as Mr. Mumbles.
As Mumbles, yeah. Maybe I'm partial because I've been working with them for months and, you know, they're my friends, but between the two performances, between the two Stanleys, I think Ian offers a more dynamic performance. I really, truly do.
I agree.
I think the tougher one, because you're either doing a Brando impression or you're not. I think the tougher one is Blanche because it's a Southern belle with a handkerchief. And how do you make that your own?
Well, and the lines are much more quotable and iconic. I mean, everybody knows kindness of strangers. I mean, like,
or strangeness of kind people.
Sarah adds a subtlety that's
much more naturalistic.
Yeah.
Right. And I think also these are iconic characters, and not just this play. It's kind of a lot of Mr. Williams' work they're kind of held on a almost pedestal.
Yes.
I think it makes that ripe for almost parody at times, like A Streetcar Named Pyramus and Thisbe.
It was funny.
Thank you, dear.
I'm going to jump in, and this is going to be controversy, but I'm just going to say
hot take. Hot take from Tom.
From the reviewer, put the reviewer hat on.
Okay.
I'm not naming any names or anything, but people who read my review will read between the lines and know what I'm talking about. I saw a play recently, and the actor, I don't know whether he chose it or the director, but he did an impression of an iconic movie performance. It really, really bothered me because this particular actor who I've worked with, I admire so much, incredible talent, I was looking forward to seeing what this actor, the stamp that he put on the role. Yeah. But it wasn't that. It was an impression of a movie performance, and it really was a distraction for me. So once again, as a from a perspective of a reviewer, I was cheerleading that I would go in to see this show, and this actor would be turning in his own performance of this particular piece. So anyway, I had fears. I don't know that, Casey, I had any doubts that that would be the choice that you would make. But it concerned me because you take a classic like this, and if you decide that you're going to, you know, copy it for whatever reason, it's not a good idea, I don't think, from the standpoint of reviewing.
I tend to not like the theatrical copy and paste plan, so.
What do you think?
Yeah.
Well, it's one thing if it's a radio play or if it's a parody, but yeah, we'll if you see me on the street, I won't tell you. So there you go, friends. All right, so before we go down a rabbit hole of silliness, tell folks the information on where to go, where to get ticket. No ticket prices, we're NPR. But where can people find the information so they can head down to New Orleans?
We are at the Indie Fringe building. We open March 3rd, and we run through the 19th. It's Friday through Sunday, 3 weekends. And you can get more information at catalystrepertory.org, indiefringe.org, or also even on
magicthreadcabaret.com.
There you go. Yeah. And Tom, once again, plug your page.
My page is On the Isle with Tom Alvarez, and my website is tomalvarez.studio.
There you go. So I know you guys have been busy. Have you watched any films lately? Because it is a film show. Or do you need something? And I guess in one case, to decompress. I don't know how you wind down at the end of the day. Tom's waving his hand vigorously, which is great for radio. Yes, sir.
I am so excited. I loved, loved, loved. And you probably saw it.
Mm.
Okay, I may mispronounce. The Irish, Banshees.
Banshees of Inisherin. I was going to say Cocaine Bear.
I have seen that.
Yeah, that's
right. There's my most recent.
We talked about it. I loved it.
McDonough. Yeah.
That made my top 10.
And see, the reason
so
I love the playwright, and you've got a great personal story about it, when Topher told you to go watch that movie.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Talk about that. But I saw it, and Deb Sargent, my lovely friend Deb Sargent, had done two of his plays at the Phoenix, which Brian directed. And I'll never forget she and Gail Steigerwald doing those Irish accents. I had a hard time understanding some of the brogue, but she leave me to be after looking for me father in the morning. I never forget that line from one of his plays because Deb often repeats it. So I love that movie. I love everything about it.
It's a thing. Well,
I'm glad you said it because I forgot that I had seen it. So.
Well, you get caught up in things. So, yeah, that made my top 10.
It's so good.
I see mostly theater and performing arts, and I made a conscious choice 2 years ago to fit in at least one film a month. Mm-hmm. Go to the movie theater. And during COVID, I was one of the first people to sit in a movie theater in COVID, just me and my mask, you know, but anyway.
But no, I think especially with that story, the extremes of, he's not that serious. And then they go, he's that serious. So
it's McDonough.
It is McDonough,
I don't want to I don't want to be a spoiler, but the donkey, I'll just say that.
But I think even in Bruges and Three Billboards, there's just like, oh, really? We're going there? Yeah you're going there. So, and that's, I think, hard to do as a filmmaker.
And he always calls them comedies.
Tell your story because it's so.
Oh, yes, so please.
Oh, so.
Welcome to the storytelling portion of film sociology.
So I don't think it's any small secret that my company, Catalyst Repertory, it's a trifecta of me and my two best friends, Dave and Taylor. Mm-hmm. And we've run this company together for 10 years. And at the start of this season, Dave kind of approached me and said, like, I need to step back. He is a new dad. He was slated to pretty much be every male lead of the season, as tends to happen to him. So, you know, he was Stanley. He was in the musical. He's in the Friends show. And, you know, I watched my friend, you know, reach his limit of what he can do. He has a day job. He has a family. And he was just like, I got to step back for a little bit. And I took it pretty hard. I'm sorry, Dave. I'm not trying to make you feel bad. we're good now, guys. But I took it pretty hard because, I mean, when you work with somebody for 10 years and, like, they're really your artistic soulmate. We speak the same language. Mm-hmm. I don't have to struggle to direct him. We just get each other. And so I was like, what am I going to do? And my boyfriend, my partner, Topher, sat me down and he was like, I just watched Banshees of Inishmer and I think you really need to sit down and watch this McDonough story because you love McDonough and it's about friendship and it's about mm-hmm. understanding how to let friends go their own way and like letting go a little bit and letting go of the reins. And I laughed and I cried through the whole movie.
Yep.
But it really did. It kind of got me to the other side of like, this isn't a breakup. This is just redefining. Like, we've known each other for 10 years. I knew him before he was married with kids. So, I mean, it's learning to meet people where they are in their life. Exactly. And it's just such a beautiful film.
It's fascinating that you mentioned it, where you work with somebody for long, and we've all had kind of our own fill in our own heads of the players, the Matthew Soucy players, the Casey Ross players,
yeah.
And then you know you work with them several times, especially in a row, and then it's done, yeah. And then or somebody you haven't worked with in a long time, and they're able to come back. I always you know it's the arts are kind of like you know college or Moneypenny. Yeah. They're always there for you.
I got
you know.
One that came back because, like,
see?
when Dave did have to back out with Streetcar, Ian came in and I saw him on the audition sheet and I was like, oh, surely that's not the Ian that I haven't seen in 11 years since college. And sure enough, he like sends me a message on Facebook and he's like, hey, gonna read for your Stanley. And I was like, oh.
You know, I'd be remiss. I've got to talk about Dustin. See, one of the things that Casey and I, we become friends.
Careful over there.
We become friends and we share confidences. And, you know, it's, I hope that she feels the same way I do. It's really developed into a real collaboration. But having said that, you know, if you find a creative soulmate in your life, she's found two of them, but I found one, Dustin, 7 years
yeah.
ago. We started yep. in a kitchen in the corner of a Christmas party. We started talking. We haven't stopped since. And we have had our ups and downs. We were like the Bickersons. You know, we've had
nice
some,
radio
we've
reference.
Had some world-class fights. Casey and I, we compare our fights that we've had with our respective collaborators, and Dustin and I have had some doozies. And most recently, I never want to see you ever again in
Actually.
My entire life. I'm done with you, whatever. But you know what? I mean, when it boils down to it, it's rare if you can share your artistic guts with another person. And,
yep.
you know, anyway, that's what I have with him. So I have to give him a shout out.
It's a really special trust.
I put him in the program. Dustin puts up with me. That's such a lame line, but it really fit with that.
As sitcom husband, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Part of this, what makes this partnership so brilliant is because Magic Thread Cabaret, our mission is to promote the cabaret art form. And to incorporate what we do with what Casey does because it fits perfectly. The Four Deuces Bar.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is what we're calling the French Quarter Bar that Dustin, in character, he's the piano
One
player.
One of my favorite hangouts.
And our vocalist, Courtney Wiggins.
Well, the characters can't escape, so sometimes they just got to go hang out at the Four
exactly.
Deuces.
Exactly.
Courtney Wiggins, this very talented vocalist, works down the street at Channel 8 as a producer for All in Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
So we brought her on just recently. So she and Dustin are playing live and singing live through the show. At appropriate times, it's not completely scored through like the original movie was in the 50s.
I was happy we were able to use that a little bit in Midsommar, and of course Brian Hart's yeah. picked up on it immediately.
You know, in so. the '50s, those popular score movies from end to end, everything.
Yeah, yeah. If I'll be watching something in from another room. I can hear my wife go, "You're watching something from the '50s,"
and yep.
I can
exactly.
hear the score and from in here.
And back then, the style was you know very schmaltzy and all that, because
and
fit
big.
The style. Yeah, yeah.
yeah.
But
Blanche
you know.
Almost calls out the style of the because like I didn't realize how magic realism Streetcar is mm-hmm. with like the fact that she's hearing music and so Williams wants the audience to hear what Blanche is hearing but it's not what the rest of the characters are hearing, which is literal magical realism
yeah.
as a theater like term. And she even says it to Mitch. She says, I don't want realism, I want magic.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like kind of my mission statement with the show. I was like, why can't you score a play live? Like, why the heck not?
Yeah.
And it's funny, that magical realism is why, for me, Athens, Louisiana was the perfect setting to do Midsummer because of that.
You'll see people walking around the world, and they'll be in the bar where the piano player and the vocalist is, and the audience will be
there. You'll get a lot of nosy neighbor Stephen Eunice. Yeah. you'll fall in love with them.
Nice. Well, I can't wait to get to the bar.
Yep.
And get to the show. So I will be. And it's now another chapter with Casey and Matt intersecting in the strangest ways.
It's true.
So, as I mentioned, Tom, last year when I did Midsummer, I did Midsummer and I did Pyramus and Thisbe for as Stanley and Blanche. And when I found out this one was going to be there, I was like, oh, man, here we go. Pressure's on.
I sat in a great place. I got the big Stanley scene and everything.
Yeah.
The shirt rip.
Dudley. Well, to be fair, we love you, Kelsey. But we did have to cut it because it was like, man, Hulk Hogan makes this look easy. So that aspect was fun. But years and years ago, I will share this with you, Tom. I love the long-form joke. In fact, there's one that's now 20 years old and still paying dividends. So when my kid was two, we were at the Children's Museum, and we were riding the carousel, them and me. And my wife is out taking the pictures, and I whisper a little something into my kid's ear. So I say, yell this one. When we passed by Mommy. And right when we crossed Mommy, I had my 2-year-old kid yell at the top of their voice, "Ride, Equus, ride!" And that became what I called sitcom wife look from my lovely wife, Lynn. And then,
you know, Lynn, I want to point out, I have such respect for her as a director and an actor, and I want to say that publicly.
Truly. Anytime you want a road trip to Earlham to see a show,
I need to do that because I like to write about educational theater.
Once I stop recording, we'll talk about that. So that was a bit. And then when my kid wanted a horsey ride, Daddy's horsey name was Equus. Then at the height of their Harry Potter fandom, who was doing a revival in New York with London with Richard Griffiths and Daniel Radcliffe, Equus.
I saw it 3 times.
Did you really?
I did. I was doing my study abroad, Shakespeare in England class in college, and it was playing in London. And like over the month that we were in England, we were in Stratford-upon-Avon, but we got like one free weekend where we could like travel around. And most of my friends went to Amsterdam and did that part of the weekend off. And I took myself by myself to see Willie Russell's Blood Brothers 3 times as well. And also that run of Equus in the West End 3 times. I just went and go to see plays.
Oh, cool.
So anyway, I've been telling the story for years. I will braggadocious about raising your kid through pop culture in one way, shape, or form. And then when this darling was going to direct Equus, my kid was 14. And it had the 16-plus thing. Let's never forget,
like
friends.
Like most Catalyst shows.
Plays are not movies. But yeah. No, but I get it. So anyway, and of course, Brian was playing. So I called Brian, and I said, hey, can we sit down on a dress rehearsal? And they said yes, and apparently rumors are going around, because I'd been telling this story for years. The Socies are coming, which sounds like a play in itself. And we go see the show, and it's in that old church in Fountain Square. And you have not lived, parents, until we get done with Act One. You've not lived until you've had your 14-year-old say, unfiltered, without any hesitation, what in the hell is wrong with you? Because they knew of the play, but never, we told them a little bit of what it was, and then they saw it.
No one knows what Equus is truly about.
Well, like, and then we get to Act Two, and they loved it, and it was amazing. And
make it to the end.
Then they started reading it, and because one of their classmates, are you reading your horse porn? And M's like, it's not pornography, it's a psychological drama about, because that's what you do when you're a teenager. Yeah, so.
I was the same teenager with my copy of Equus and my Who CDs and my plan to do a rock and roll Equus.
I've never heard horse porn before.
That. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Well, and I think the whole that's where the stereotype. Oh, it's
naked horseplay.
Yeah, it's sex.
You guys
there's
have
sex and there's a horse.
You two have had,
it's not a horse sex play. No, that's not that play. It's not Tijuana.
Yeah. We have all kinds of history. Sounds like.
Oh yeah. So this has been, and we did Richard III together.
Yes.
Although not together. I mean, same show, different thing. But we have a fun mosaic
of. That's what I love about Indianapolis theater.
We're intergenerated in a weird way.
This is what I love about.
Do a lot of crossover events. A little bit. Crossing over.
Yep.
The indie theater scene, it truly is incestuous.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone's got 2 degrees of separation.
Thanks, Tennessee Williams. It's funny. So I mean, kudos to tackling this one. I mean, it's there's not a lot of William plays except for Glass Menagerie. Everybody will do Glass Menagerie till the end of time.
I've done it twice, and I was old enough for Laura, obviously, in high school when I did that.
Yes.
But I was Amanda in college as my acting thesis.
Right.
And far too young to be Amanda when I.
But that's the thing. That's the perks of college and high school. You do those.
I've gotten to do. One of the greatest Williams plays from both angles, so go me.
But I mean, it's a question of, you know, when do you try to do the others? Maybe All My Sons. It's less rapey than other. Yeah. But it was the same thing with I did one Albie play. I don't think I need to do another Albie play as long as I live.
I'm gonna do that out that
That's
same
another
Albie play
quote
eventually.
I'm gonna long remember less rapey.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's kind of
his work has
a little
certain
bit,
undertone.
A little bit. So
there's always repressed homosexuality and some R word.
Oh, Brick's just confused. He's just misunderstood.
You know, there are small things about the play that I really appreciate. I was telling Courtney, think about it. Tennessee Williams cast a black woman and a white woman as friends.
Yeah.
Yep.
And they open the scene. That the symbolism.
Stella's
of
line
that,
there, mixed
that's right.
The optics of that are huge. Think about it.
Can we do Milk Cow and just dress everybody up like Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton and boom? Yes. I know you're up for that.
Yes.
Nice.
You know, the language of the play too is dated. You know, I wonder if he were writing that scene now, whether he would use the word Stella calls. The young husband degenerate, you know. Surely he would have changed.
Right.
That.
Yeah, there's that the learning challenge lingo. Mm-hmm.
Then and this is now.
Right.
You know.
Right, right.
I'm sure people
Williams was struggling with his own identity.
Oh, we know.
Quite a bit. So.
Yep.
That's the challenge of watching something that was written that long ago and now and thinking in terms of, you know, how pejorative they are today.
Well, we haven't changed the script, but we've changed a couple words that are, it's dated to the point where it's stuff that you just don't want to stay on stage.
Got it.
Like Sarah very sweetly asked me, she's like, do I have to call this black woman this?
Right.
Can I say something else?
Something else.
And I was like, yes, absolutely, because that's not taking away from the content of the play. That's taking away unnecessary pain in your audience.
Correct.
You know?
So, and speaking of pain in audience, no. So, so once again, where can people go for tickets and information?
Indie Fringe. We're opening this Friday, running March 3rd through 19th, and tickets are available at indiefringe.org, catalystrepertory.org, and magicthread.com.
Guys, thanks for hanging out.
Thank you. This was fun.
You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. I'll talk about what I've been watching this week, then we'll go around the horn, and then we'll grab a pencil and find out what you have been watching. I went and saw Creed 3 on Thursday evening. That's what happens sometimes. And as I've said many times on this program, I most sequels I just don't need. And this one... I understand on paper why there has to be a Creed 3, and for a couple reasons. And especially, I think, in the case of Michael B. Jordan, who is not only starring in this one, but he's directing it. And there is no Clubber Lang Jr. in this one. I understand that Jordan probably wanted to do an Adonis Creed story without any of the other players from the past. Stallone's not in this one. He is still given a producer credit, but everything from his universe is in there. His trainer, Drago's son, not Dolph Lundgren, is back in here. And so we get the story of it on its own merits, as opposed to rehashing old characters. So that I understand, but I'm still, oh God, we're in the third film. The third Creed film. So... And kudos to Jonathan Majors, who plays Damian Anderson, a friend from Adonis's past. And as the film goes on, we find out what is the connection between them and how Majors shows up, how Damian shows up, and soon has a face, or a heel turn for you wrestling fans out there that builds up. Adonis Creed is enjoying retirement. He's got his family. He's got his gym. He's got his own promotional company. And it all is kind of put up on the line because of this old friend who's just gotten out of jail and wants to fight. We also find out about you're dealing with your past. Creed doesn't like to talk about his past, even though we're in the third Creed film. And we also find out about the sins of the mother. Felisa Rashad is back as Creed's mother, and she has one really nice scene, and that's kind of why she's in this. So that aspect of it is fine. And Jordan's good with the intimate stuff, with the two people scenes. And so that's kind of cool. The fight scenes are okay. There is, and there's a film I watched earlier this week involving a sporting event that probably marred my watching of this film. And we'll get to that in a little bit. This is the first film, and I remember doing this with the first two Creed films, and I'm sure part of it is because we have a new person behind the camera as opposed to Ryan Coogler, who's directing, I really like. But there's fight scenes in which I did not have a physical reaction. You know, when there is a knockout, sometimes you jump back in your seat, or you put your head back. There's some physical response. That, unfortunately, Creed 3 doesn't have that. The ring itself, and also the ring looks weird. And I think it's we're in CG land, especially with the climax of the film, which is supposed to be at a stadium, which is supposed to be at the Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles. But I do want to give the film credit because they do something I'd never seen in a boxing film before, and it's not really giving away anything, but it is the montage to move the fight along. Not giving away a whole lot, but I believe the final fight goes for 12 rounds. And they do something with CG used for good, and it's a little heavy-handed, but the fact that it moves along, and I've never seen it done like this, I will give it props. So it's overall, it's fine. If you're a fan of the Rocky Creed series, go for it. See it on a big screen. But yeah, so I guess it could have been a lot worse. So long as it's not Rocky V, we're going to be okay. So yeah, Creed 3 is fine. It opens this week. Go check it out if you're into that. And I'll get to the film that, marred my viewing of Creed 3 in a little bit. We're going through some titles on video. I have learned, friends, that there is no good time of the day to prepare yourself to watching films based on the work of the Marquis de Sade. From Blue Underground, there are two films that I got to watch recently. One called Justine, and the other called Eugenie, or also known as Marquis de Sade's Philosophy in the Boudoir. Justine's from 1969, Eugenie's from 1970, if I remember right. And these are both directed by Jess Franco, Spanish director. Probably the thing I remember about him most is Jess Franco's Count Dracula, a.k.a. the one with Christopher Lee with a mustache as Dracula. But I believe Justine is his biggest budgeted picture, so take that for what that's worth. But I think Jess Franco does with the works of Marquis de Sade that Roger Corman did with the works of Edgar Allan Poe. It's a loose adaptation, I will say that. There is skin, there is flesh, there is torture, there is pleasure, there is a gray area in between those. But it's just kind of an art. But throwing his name around is an arty way of promoting a skin flick. or as Patty Duke said in the Valley of the Dolls, nudies. And they're not that nudie, at least by today's standards. So, and in this you have, in Justine, which is, I think, the better of the two films, we have two girls who are leaving an orphanage, both virgins, and about ready to go into the adult world. Or, well, that pun was intended. Or the grown-up world, or the real world, for what have you. We have Klaus Kinski playing the Marquis de Sade, who I think it's like a half a day's filming. He's just in a cell in a white powdered wig writing. But this film also has Mercedes McCambridge as a prisoner who helps out and becomes one of Justine's makes Justine one of her henchwomen. Jack Palance is in this as a guy who runs what looks like a religious order, and it's more like a cult, as one would expect. Romina Power, who is the daughter of Tyrone Power, yes. Is the star of this. She plays Justine. Apparently was 16 when she made this. I found this out after the fact. So there's a little... So anyway, Justine and her friend leave. They wind up going down different paths. One is trying to be virtuous and just keeps getting hit with group after group, bad group after bad group after bad group, getting in jail, escaping jail. Winding up in a cult. The other one becomes a prostitute and has a comfortable living and winds up becoming an heiress. Also, as I wrote in my notes watching this film, all men and women are terrible in this film. They're out to con you and fleece you and take off your clothes, and yeah. So that's kind of what that is what Justine is on Blue Underground. Also from Blue Underground, again, is Eugenie, also known as the Marquis de Sade's philosophy in the boudoir, where, and this one has Christopher Lee, who is narrating some works of Marquis de Sade. Again, it's just enough to, and you know, Lee brings a little bit of credibility. I'm guessing 1, maybe 2 days worth of work. Maria Rahm, who is also in the other film, is in this one. She's a woman who, as where you find out, is having an affair with a married man and talks the married man into bringing his 18-year-old daughter, I forget, to her remote island for a pleasure vacation. And, of course, things are not as they seem, and it has much more dark and sinister and sexual plans for the plucky young one. Yeah, and this one is in a modern setting. So again, the whole thing of, and the very first scene is Lee reading some works of de Sade while a ceremony is happening on stage, or in a studio, I should say. Yeah, this is another one. I'm just kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop, and when does it get bad? And these are not explicit because it is the early, late 60s, early 70s. We get some more Lee voiceover of the Marquis de Sade while there is a whipping of the girl an hour into the film. And, yeah, it's just, it's not porn. It's just a Euro skin flick with some name stars. And so when I say that, it's also not Caligula either. So, yeah. So I can say now I've seen two of the films inspired loosely featuring the work of the Marquis de Sade, directed by Jess Franco. And they are out on video and Blu-ray if you want to check those out. Marquis de Sade's Justine and Eugenie, Marquis de Sade's Philosophy in the Boudoir, both available from Blue Underground. And you'll love the plucky 60s pop score in Eugenie. It's not as abrasive as, say, Dracula in 1972 AD. But yeah, so those films are out there. Also, from Film Movement, and this is one, it's not the band, it's apparently based on a very popular children's book, a young adult book series that I never read, Belle and Sebastian, The Adventure Continues. These are from France, it's set in 1945. We have a plane with Cousin Angelina crashing, and there apparently were no survivors, but young Sebastian is determined that his cousin is actually alive because she's that powerful a person. And his wolf dog, Belle. This is a sequel. I'd not seen the first one. It's okay. You can watch this on and off its own if you have. They hire a pilot. The grandfather of Sebastian hires a pilot to go search after this initial search party, quits. The boy and the animal sneak on a plane, and of course, their plane crashes. Pilot is grumpy because, you know, his plane crashed. And then it becomes that kind of young adult survival tale, and adult and child don't like each other, and they have to learn to work together. So, yeah, it's and as I mentioned on Facebook and Twitter, this was the first film I watched involving a bear after Cocaine Bear, and still not bonkers enough for me. So, but yeah, so, and of course, Belle has that great Lassie sense of figuring out trouble way ahead of the humans. So, yeah, it's fine. So if you have young people, they'll probably get more than I did. Belle and Sebastian, The Adventure Continues, from Film Movement, dubbed version from Film Movement. From Bayview Entertainment is a drama called Northern Shade. Not Evening Shade and not Northern Exposure. No, we have a guy who is a veteran who is spending his days as a civilian getting drunk on his boat and having really bad PTSD. And then finding, and he's an Uber driver during the pandemic. I have to give kudos. They actually did the film in mask and used that as a plot point. And this will be an interesting footnote in cinema history as time goes on. Remember in Glass Onion how they addressed the mask issue at the beginning and then were able to move on past it. this one, they were able to utilize it to the advantage of the film. Justin, the driver, finds out that his younger brother, he's been looking for his younger brother and has turned out to become a part of a militia, an extremist militia group that stays out in the woods and does training and is getting ready for their big moment, probably January 6th. We also have a moment of a few moments where Justin has a shadowy figure and talking, he's always in the darkness. You can't see his face, but it's a friend of his. It's the voice of his own conscience or the fellow soldier friend of his that was killed in combat. So it was one of these kind of low-budget films that you're able to shoot out in the middle of nowhere, permits or not, and able to utilize the woods area for action. It's an okay film as well. There is a collaboration between a private investigator and the soldier veteran trying to find his brother. And it's like, is it, and does the film become brother versus brother? Is the younger brother that brainwashed, or does it become a brother rescue? So not really giving away a whole lot there, but if you're into military dramas, especially The War at Home, check out Northern Shade from Bayview Entertainment. And finally, the film I mentioned earlier of a film involving a sporting event that helped knock off Creed 3 a little bit when it comes to sports action. And this is also, friends, this is I had a Wednesday. This was the perfect Wednesday for me. And we look for days like this because it's not just the movie, it's the experience. You think about maybe the roar of the crowd or how the crowd responded, and maybe it's the person you're with or the friends that you're with or the date that you're with, and you know what happened before the movie and what happens after the movie. All that kind of rolls into a good experience and sometimes a bad experience. It took me, and I use an example. It took me a long time to rekindle a liking for The Princess Bride because I went on a really bad double date when I first saw it in theaters. So it took me years to be able to watch it. And I remember liking the film then, but this bad double date just kind of marred everything and just kind of put a thing in the punch bowl about it. So it took me years to go and revisit that film and like it once again. Love it once again, really. Anyway, so my Wednesday was being in the recording studio, this very one right here, that I'm in now, banging out film or the Blues House Party, doing the interview with Tom and Casey, and then getting home, and grilling some chicken and roasting some potatoes and opening a bottle of wine, and I sat down and watched the 1977 terrorist drama Black Sunday. And it's a film that for some of a certain age, and I'm being one of them, I was 7 when this film came out, and the ad campaign was very effective. It's basically it's a film based on a Thomas Harris novel. This is early in Harris's career before the Hannibal Lecter series. But it's about a Vietnam vet, a disgraced Vietnam vet who helps organize a terrorist plot to fly the Goodyear blimp into the Super Bowl and have a mass shooting. There is a kind of a Claymore device that is attached to the blimp, and the ad campaign of the blimp crashing into a stadium full of spectators was very effective for 7-year-old me. Bruce Dern plays the pilot. Robert Shaw plays the counter-terrorist assigned to stop the plot. Marthy Keller, the Swiss actress who we knew prior to this in Marathon Man, and I just read in Nathan Raven's Happy Place about her performance in Billy Wilder's Fedora, is also the female accomplice for Dern, and they have an interesting, unhealthy relationship with each other. But this was kind of it is a disaster movie it's kind of a subplot of the disaster movies. It's not Irwin Allen, it's not Airport or The Poseidon Adventure or The Towering Inferno. This was more like, where terrorism is your disaster. So a film like this, or a film that came out, as I learned, 4 months before this, 2 Minute Warning, which was the sniper targeting a football game from Universal. This was put out by Paramount. Directed by John Frankenheimer, Ernest Lehman's one of the screenwriters on this. And this is, as a kid in the 70s, or as a filmgoer in the 70s, we've seen these kind of international plots, international political crime plots. Subdued performance from Robert Shaw. He'd got this after doing Jaws 2 years prior. We get not full blown Bruce Dern. We get him at probably like a 7, but that's still pretty good. Marthy Keller's an interesting choice. She's just wears a headscarf and holds a gun, and that's really the most that her scenes with Dern are particularly effective, and probably the best part of her performance. But we have the setup of the plot, the assignment that this plot needs to be stopped, and we're all kind of waiting for the final 20 minutes of the film of when the blimp is taken over and how is Shaw going to stop them and what's going to happen in the game. And so listening to the couple special features on this, they actually had cameras at the Super Bowl in Miami, Pittsburgh, and Dallas. And this is something I don't think you could really pull off today unless you had major restrictions with the filmmakers and the studio. The last time that I remember a film crew getting on the field for an event was the aftermath of the World Series and the baseball remake of Pitch Perfect with Jimmy Fallon and Drew Barrymore. Bad film. So the fact that they were able to film during the game, and they wound up doing a couple other stadium shots, not involving the Super Bowl, I think one in Dallas or one in Houston and another in Los Angeles, if I remember right. But just seeing them on the field in the stands, I will bring up one shot in particular that's really impressive, and kudos to John Frankenheimer and Robert Shaw to pull this off. In one take, you see Shaw on the upper mezzanine of a stadium, and then you see Shaw bolt down some stairs to the lower mezzanine, go across the curve of the stadium. You see a security guy kind of make a grab at Shaw, and Shaw keeps running, hops over a fence, runs on the sidelines while the game is going on, and then hops over a fence and into a truck. It's almost as impressive as Burt Lancaster's railroad run in the other John Frankenheimer film from the 1965's The Train. See that film as well. It's great. But yeah, it was very impressive. And that's something, again, you couldn't pull off today. And the fact that they shot it in a stadium with actual extras. This is not the cut and paste CG audience, High Creed 3, you know, it's easy to do that these days. This was, I mean, this was very impressive and some really good stunt work with, because the climax of the film involves Shaw's character on the blimp trying to hook, put a hook onto the top of the blimp so they can move the blimp elsewhere and they can fire at shots. Claymores, not the darts, but something of that. There is a great moment of Bruce Stern's character wants to do a test shoot of these explosives, and they go to a barn, and a guy winds up showing up, and they wind up saying they were posing as photographers. Could they photograph him with this brand new fangled camera? And when they use it to explode, a whole side of a barn is filled with holes, and then you get to see gleeful, eccentric performance from Bruce Dern, loving the plot that's the test shoot that goes off really well. Anyway, the film is about 2 hours and 25 minutes, and you could probably shave a good 20 minutes off of it. I think there's obviously the setup, and you know, getting the equipment and finding the people. So it does take its time to build up to the final 20 minutes, which is pretty gangbusters, I have to admit. But this is those films that happened back then. It wasn't the same success as I heard in the documentary of Star Wars or Close Encounters. It made some money, but they also mentioned that 4 months prior to this was the release of 2 Minute Warning, which not that great a film. So, but yeah, it was fun to revisit Black Sunday. There's also a documentary about John Frankenheimer, and if you should check out his work if you haven't. Manchurian Candidate, films like The Manchurian Candidate, The Train, this film, 52 Pickup. I mean, quite a career, and referred to as one of those actors directors. Started out doing live television, so actors love working with him because of that great training. He worked under Sidney Lumet before starting to make films on his own, including All Fall Down, Birdman of Alcatraz, I mentioned, 7 Days in May. That's one I need to revisit. If you're a fan of Jan, you know, if you want to read more about January 6, check out 7 Days in May. The Train I mentioned from 1964, he did Seconds, yeah, I'm scrolling, with Rock Hudson. Grand Prix, also from 1966, with great camera work. I mean, this is a film that's a little too long for my taste as well, but man, it looks great. Got an Oscar for Best Editing, as well as Sound and Sound Effects, and well-deserved. The Extraordinary Seamen, The Fixer, so anyway, just really good work from John Frankenheimer. So check that out. So that is out from Arrow Video, Black Sunday, and I'm glad I got to revisit it. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Let's find out what's going on over at IU and in Franklin, and then we'll grab a pencil. All right, Friday, March 3rd, 7 o'clock, the International Art House Series, Tar, with Cate Blanchett. Oscars are a week from Sunday. I might tell you, I'm not going to predict, I might just say if I had a ballot, that'll be next week's show. Saturday, March 4th at 4 o'clock from 1956 is a part of the City Lights film series, A Man Escaped. On Saturday, March 4th at 7 p.m., Women on Top, Legacies of Women in Global Cinema, Mara Matushka, Painting on Celluloid. Sunday, March 5th, 1 o'clock, National Theater Live's Henry V with Kit Harington, for you Game of Thrones fans. And then next thing will be Tuesday, March 21st at 7 p.m. will be Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always. So they'll be on spring break. That is happening over at IU Cinema at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin. Friday, March 3rd, 7:30 p.m., The Whale. Saturday, March 4th. Oh, this is the part of the Best of Fest 2023 for Heartland Films. March 4th, Saturday, 2:30 p.m., the 2022 film Rally Caps. Saturday, March 4th at 5 p.m., Butterfly in the Sky. And then Saturday, March 4th at 7:30 p.m., Everything Everywhere All at Once. All of that. And then Friday, March 10th, 13 going on 30. Friday, March 10th at 7:30 p.m. Let's see. And then Saturday, March 11th at 7:30 p.m., The Hangover. And then, yes, March 17th and March 18th, Friday and Saturday, 2 and 7:30 p.m., The Quiet Man. And then Saturday, Friday and Saturday, March 24th and 25th, 2 and 7:30 p.m., Francis Ford Coppola's The Outsiders. And then Friday and Saturday, March 31st and April 1st, no fooling, 2 and 7:30 p.m., Stanley Kubrick's 2001, A Space Odyssey. All of that is happening at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin. All right, friends, let's grab a pencil. Let's find out what you've been watching this week. Hopefully you've been able to watch some movies that are good and new, or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. We start on Twitter with Sarah, who writes, "We watched Nasty Baby last weekend with Kristen Wiig, Sebastian Silva, and I was unprepared for the turn it took in the end." Whew. All right, Sarah, hang in there. Your Canadian girlfriend writes Cocaine Bear. Indy Andrea writes Cocaine Bear. This is going to happen a lot. Oh, speaking of friends, Golden Globus Theater this week. They're doing Speed, and man, like me, should have stopped when the bus was stopped. So yeah, you can hear them. You can hear them make fun of Speed quite a bit. It was a good action film, but yeah, way too long. So, and next month for Golden Globus Theater, because their anniversary is coming up, they're going to be discussing the Mad Max films. And so next week will be the first Mad Max film from Golden Globus Theater. Check them out. Fun guys. Okay. Now on Facebook, I love Eric Bryant, and you should too. But Eric writes, "Smile. Interesting premise. Creepy moments. Terrible dialogue." And I've known Eric for a while, so I was able to write, "Are you asking, is this the most recent horror film or the Bruce Dern beauty pageant satire from the 70s? And his response was, "There is a horror film called Smile." So thank you, Eric. Jeff writes, "The Duke and the Indian Runner." Abdul Kim Shabazz, says, "I plan to see 65 this weekend, and it has dead people." All right, smart guy. Jamie writes, "The Greatest Showman, Encanto, Dear Evan Hansen, The 355, Gunpowder Milkshake, and The Hating Game." Krista writes, "Oh, you know, just the groundbreaking cinematic feat that was Cocaine Bear." Uh-huh. Patty writes, "All the President's Men, Atlantis, The Lost Empire, the Sir Kenneth Branagh edition of Death on the Nile, and Persuasion." Nancy writes, "The Fablemans, beautifully shot and some lovely acting, but thought the story was very disjointed. Too many storylines and no payoff for any of them." Okay. Michelle writes, "The Menu. LOL, I can't decide if this is my new favorite foodie movie or not. That was nuts, but I loved it." And then wrote Silence of the Lambs. Now there's a double feature, Michelle. I hope that was a double feature. Jessica writes, "Oh, my stage boo." Jessica's in the production of The Great Gatsby that's happening at Arts for Lawrence. Go look that up. In the Mouth of Madness and Lord of Illusions. Doug writes, "Till the Clouds Roll By, Sabotage, and more 2022 Oscar nominees. Close, Tell It Like a Woman, The Quiet Girl, Puss in Boots, The Last Wish, Housemaid of Splinters, Navalny, and The Beauty and the Bloodshed." Garland writes, Crazy Rich Asians, Les Mis, the Liam Neeson version, and Cocaine Bear. Eric writes, "First View, the mysterious and disturbing EO. His rewatches this week, Gladiator for the first time in two decades. Better, but still not great. Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom for the first time in 16 years. Z, chilling masterpiece for our time." Yeah, I'm with you on that, Eric. Yes, folks, so watch Z again. Check that out. And 7 Days in May. But don't do a double feature of those. My God. Edge of Tomorrow and Gene Hackman, Ellen Burstyn, and Anne Margaret in Twice in a Lifetime from 1985. First time since it was released. As good as I remembered. Thank you, Eric. Helen writes, "I, Tanya, and Whiplash." Daniel writes Gilda and the Imitation Game. Because Daniel's in a production of Breaking the Code at Richmond Civic, so go check that out. That's opening up soon. Brian writes, first-time watches in the past week, The Far Country, Enemy, Tootsie, and Marnie. Yeah, I kind of got on Brian a little bit to watch Tootsie, because that is something Mrs. Sosie and I did over the weekend. We went to the Phoenix and saw their version of Madea, as I mentioned on the earlier in the interview. Mojada is his name. I got to get better at that, folks. Sorry. Old straight white dude. Trying to be better. And so anyway, we saw Mojada, then we saw Oedipus, and then on Sunday we watched Tootsie at home. So we had to cleanse the palate. Because I jokingly said, well, we should cleanse our palate with Night Mother or Sophie's Choice. Okay, Allison writes Kick-Ass and Kick-Ass 2. JJ writes The Wolf of Wall Street, Cocaine Bear, What a Ride, The Other Lamb, The Living Daylights, Smile, good premise but predictable, and this was last year's horror film. And Swingers, comfort watching for a Gen Xer. Okay, JJ, thank you. Nick Rogers writes, we have a ghost, Eck the Tiger, Tigers in the High, Local Hero. Yeah, look up the Midwest Film Journal's write-up on Local Hero, Nick Rogers one. Erotic Nightmare, The Deadly Camp, War, and Blacklight. Taylor writes Crazy Rich Asians and Little Caesar. Rachel writes Blackbeard's Ghost. Nikki writes Barbarian, Cocaine Bear, and Wayne's World. Jay also writes Cocaine Bear. Linda writes Empire of Light, great acting, kind of sad, but hopeful. Amanda went to the library, The Rain People, Godfather Coda, The Death of Michael Corleone, it's an edit, King Richard, The 100-Year-Old Man, Paper Moon, and Francis Ford Coppola's Tetro. Very operatic. I think a lot of Coppola's films are operatic in tone, and Tetro is definitely one of them. Kurt writes, A Man Called Ove for Foreign Film Friday at Bell Terrace. Everything, Everywhere, All at Once at the Cinema. Yeah, if you like The Man Called Otto, check out A Man Called Ove. I remember that film, it was like number 10 of my best of that year. So, Robert Muggy writes, After Sun and the September issue. Bill writes, The Whale and the Four Seasons. Relationships dramas. They make you think. Thank you, Bill. Everin writes Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, Hook, and The Big Lebowski. Terry writes Phantom Lady, Nightmare, Gentle Night, Joy of Learning, and The Far Country. Kevin writes Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, Till, Jimi Hendrix, Electric Church, and The Banshees of Inisherin. Zachariah writes The Quiet Girl, Memoria, East of Eden, A Face in the Crowd, and Wild River. Missy writes Binging Old Will and Grace. Anthony writes The Menu. Gary writes The Hidden Fortress, Airplane, The Devil Bat, Wild Guitar, Blood Shack, Hidden Figures, An American Hippie in Israel, and The Riff Tracks Treatment of Samurai Cop. Gary writes Just Saw Quantumania, I Didn't Hate It. And finally, John writes The Man Who Shot Lee Marvin? Are you sure it's not The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance? I get what you're going there. And Doc Hollywood. And that's what you've been watching, friends. That's what you've been watching this week. So hopefully you got to watch some films that are good and that are new, at least new to you, and falling back on old favorites. Friends, some words to live by.
Silent Breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. And thanks for listening. We'll do this again next week. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
Parent, are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!